And now it's time for Dr. Dave and Shrink Wrap Radio.
You're on the couch again with Dr. Dave. And Shrink Wrap Radio is playing on again. Yeah. It's all in your head. It's all in your head. Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
Most of us think of autism as a disability. And I have to say, the first time I heard the expression differently abled, I thought it struck me as more of a euphemism than anything else. However, as time has gone on, I've really come to understand the underlying truth of that idea of people who function differently than us so-called normals are in fact differently abled, that they have a brain that functions somewhat differently than ours does, and in fact, we can learn quite a bit from them. Instead of using the term normal, we should probably use the term neurotypical. And people who have a different sort of brain and a different sort of experience, we can refer to as neuroatypical. They have different styles of thinking. My guest today is a good example of that. Dr. Temple Grandin is both someone with Asperger's and someone who has a visual style of thinking. Interestingly, Asperger's seems to be kind of in, if you will, these days, due to shows like Bones. And in fact, I suspect that Dr. Temple Grandin may have been the inspiration for the fictional character Dr. Temperance Brennan on the very popular TV show Bones. So we can learn both about the functioning of the brain. We can also learn tolerance as a result of listening to someone like Dr. Grandin. I suspect that you may have heard of her already. She's particularly noted for her hug machine that she developed. She's also been the subject of an HBO movie titled Temple Grandin, which starred Claire Danes and received 5 Emmys and is available on Netflix. If you haven't seen that movie, I highly recommend it to you. As a result of the film and as a result of the many books that she's written, she's a frequent speaker, and I feel very lucky to be able to get her for our show. So let's go right to the interview. Dr. Temple Grandin, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Well, it's good to be here.
And so happy to have this opportunity to speak with you about your work on such short notice. Rupert Isaacson of the Horse Boy movie and book suggested you as a good follow-up for the interview that I recently did with him. And of course, I already knew of your work, but that little shove from him really caused me to get off the dime and really want to contact you.
Okay.
And I suspect most of my listeners will be familiar with you. You're so widely known. You've written books about your work and your life. And there's even been an HBO film about your life. You've been a presenter at the prestigious TED.com conference. And I believe there are various, I know there are videos of you on YouTube. So I haven't had as much time to prepare for the interview as I usually do, but I'm hoping we can cover ground that's current and fresh for you. Was there a point as a child that you realized that you were unique, that your way of experiencing the world was different from others?
Well, I didn't know that as a child. When I was a child, I thought everybody was a visual thinker. And the HBO movie shows exactly how I think. They did an absolutely fantastic job on showing how my visual mind works. I thought everybody thought in pictures. I didn't know it was different, and I didn't really understand how different it was until I did my book, Thinking in Pictures, and that would have been in the mid-90s, and I started interviewing people about how they think, because if I say to you, think about a church steeple, I was shocked to find out that a lot of people just get this sort of vague, generic church steeple, or if I said highway overpass,
yeah,
they just get this vague thing. I see specific ones. You know, I'm seeing the one that's Harmony Road and I-25 and they go to the airport. It's specific. And that was a shocker to me to find out that other people were much more verbal and much less specific than I was.
Yes, I'm one of those verbal thinkers myself. It feels like I think in words. And yet, you know, we dream at night. So I sort of have the feeling that there's this subterranean stream of visual images that's running beneath the surface for all of us.
Well, I think that's true because there's a type of Alzheimer's where it's called frontal temporal lobe dementia, where the language parts of the brain get wrecked. And as they get wrecked, you take somebody that had no previous interest in arts, now starts doing art. You see, I think the visual thinking and the mathematical thinking is covered up with more verbal language.
Yes. Now, when you see an image, it sounds like you see it very clearly. Are you able to sustain that image for a period of time?
Yes, I can. In fact, if I just flick through images quickly, they come up just as the HBO movie shows it as a series of still images. But if I hold the image, then it starts turning into a video. And when I designed my cattle handling equipment, I could actually test run equipment in my head. I could run the equipment and I could go, that's not going to work, or that is going to work. And when I first started out in my 20s, I didn't know other people couldn't do this. And I said they were stupid. Well, it turned out it's not stupidity. It's lack of visual thinking. And I think a lack of visual thinking maybe caused the accident at the Japanese nuclear power plant. Because when the earthquake hit, the emergency generators came on, the pumps were running, everything was fine. But then the tsunami came and it drowned the generators that run the emergency pumps. Well, the generators weren't in a waterproof building. That's the sort of stuff I would have seen that. You know, and there's also another kind of mind, the pattern thinker, the mathematical mind. And that kind of mind would have designed the nuclear reactor itself. But they need to have a visual thinker working on this project to see stuff that's obvious to me, like, oh, no backup for the seawall. You know, nuclear power plant is supposed to have a backup for everything. Well, the seawall has no backup, and the generators got wet, and boy, that was a lot of trouble fast.
Boy, I'll say so. I've recently been reading Oliver Sacks, and he described some fascinating visual experiences as the result of surgery that he had on his eye,
yes,
where there was a blind spot, and somehow his brain was filling in the rest of the picture.
Well, the visual system in a normal person has a blind spot, right, where all the nerves from the retina go,
yes,
into the main circuit, and the visual system fills that in. It's sort of like Photoshop, you know, you want to take something out of a picture, then you fill it in with the background.
Right, right. And he was getting very clear, also, I believe, very clear, detailed pictures coming in from things that he wasn't aware that he had even noticed. And that recall, I think it was Walter Penfield, who years ago did a brain stimulation of the cortex, and people would get these very specific visual images to where they could count the pickets on the white fence outside the home that they grew up in.
Well, that's right. That's right. And Oliver Sacks, is really very much a verbal person. But now something with this eye surgery is uncovering the visual parts of the brain.
Yes. Now, what do you wish your teachers had done differently when you were a young child? I mean, clearly you thought differently than most of your other peers. Are there things that you wish your teachers had recognized or had done differently?
The big mistake that was done with me is they didn't jump me to geometry. I had a horrible time with algebra. And I'm finding a lot of photorealistic visual thinkers like me absolutely cannot do algebra. And when I talk about this in meetings and I talk about geometry and trig, I have a lot of people come up to me and says, yeah, I did terrible in algebra, but I could do geometry and trig. And the big mistake that was made with me is I never got to take geometry or trig. And that was a gigantic, huge mistake. Because algebra is not the prerequisite for geometry and trig in the more visual kind of mind. And what people forget is geometry was invented before algebra. Now, I just want to talk about another kind of mind. It's the pattern thinker.
Yeah.
I think in photorealistic visual pictures, the mathematical mind, the musical mind, thinks in patterns. It's like a more abstract visual thinking where it's patterns rather than photorealistic pictures. These kids often have trouble reading. This is a kid where he might be in fourth grade and he needs to be studying the high school math book, but he may still need some special ed in reading.
How about you? Were you an early reader, a late reader?
By third grade, they were trying to teach me with this dreadful Dick and Jane books, like, look, 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 see what, you know, look, look, go, 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 you know, that kind of stuff.
I remember those. Yeah.
Hated those. And Mother taught me to read. She took about a fifth grade level book, and the book that we read was about Clara Barton, a famous nurse. And Mother had me just start sounding out my words. And within one semester of just, she'd work with me for an hour every afternoon, I was reading it above grade level. And then I became a speed reader. I became a really good reader. But using those Dick and Jane books was useless. And I learned with phonics. But there's other kids on the autism spectrum that learn with sight words. They pick up whole words. They don't learn with phonics. So, you know, some kids are phonics learners, some are not.
What advice would you give to teachers who have high-end autistic children in their classroom?
Build up the strengths. If the kid's good at art, work on building that up. We've got to think about what are they going to do when they grow up. My ability in art was always encouraged. Kid's good in math, oh, let's build that up. We got to think about what are they going to do when they grow up. Another thing is, take the kid's fixations. These kids get fixated on stuff like trains. Well, then let's read a book about trains. Let's do math with trains. Broaden it out. Don't try to stomp out the fixation. Use that huge motivation of the fixation.
What was your experience in school generally?
Well, elementary school, I went to a small school, 12 kids in a class, older, experienced teachers. That actually went fairly well. High school and the large girls' school was a disaster. I just couldn't handle those that social pressure cooker. I got kicked out for fighting. And I ended up going to a boarding school for gifted kids with problems. And that went a lot better, but I still had problems with fighting. And one of the things I had to learn to do when kids teased me is I had to learn to cry. In other words, I had to replace anger with crying. And when I replaced anger with crying, I was still miserable. But they took away horseback riding when I got in fights. So that somehow just made me switch. And I also want to really credit my science teacher because he got me motivated in studying. A mentor teacher can make such a difference.
Oh, yes.
In the HBO movie, he showed how he got me hooked on the optical illusion room. And that really really turned me on. And I actually did build that. All the things that I built that are shown in the HBO movie, I actually built. The gate, I designed the dip vat system, the optical illusion room, the squeezing machine. I actually built all those projects. And incidentally, the HBO movie is out in DVD. You can buy it on Amazon or any of the other book sites.
Okay, good. I was just going to ask you about that. Now, what do you think about the idea of mainstreaming in the schools where they put special needs kids with the neurotypical kids?
Well, for some kids, it's the best thing you can do. I think for young autistic children, they need the social contact in elementary school. I feel a lot more strongly about encouraging mainstreaming with the elementary school kids. But when they get to high school, they kind of go two ways. And so much of it depends upon the particular school and a particular situation. You got one Asperger kid goes to high school, gets in with the computer geeks or whatever, and does just fine. You have another kid that's teased to death and just needs to be taken out. There are some of these kids just getting tortured with teasing where they need to just finish high school online. Because I'm going to be real serious about this. Socializing with teenagers is not a life skill that I need. I don't have to socialize with teenagers at work.
That's an interesting point. You're working at a university. I recently retired from a university. What do you think about online education?
Well, I think it definitely has a place. I don't think it's going to replace all classes. I don't know how you're going to do chemistry lab online. You know, there's some things I think we actually need to do it. And I'm very concerned that so many schools and so many states are taking out the hands-on classes. You know, sewing, cooking, art, wood shop, welding, drafting. Because I think that these classes teach practical problem-solving skills. Also, they teach you things that you can turn into a job, especially in these hard economic times. And I loved those classes. If I hadn't had sewing when I was younger and art and then wood shop and building things when I was older, I would have just gone absolutely nowhere. And I'm seeing a lot of kids today, they don't know how to problem solve. And doing these hands-on things teaches that.
Yes, yes. Now, how about the transition to college? High school was so difficult socially. Was your college experience turn out to be better?
I had a lot of problems socially at college. I got stuck in a room with two other roommates. That was terrible. Couldn't sleep, couldn't think. That was absolutely awful. But I'm seeing today some problems that I didn't have. Things like interrupting classes. You know, I learned that you've got to give the other students a chance to talk, and that gets back to teaching basic social rules. And the way you teach that to autistic kids is you don't scream at them if they interrupt. You just say, Tommy, you have to wait and give somebody else a chance to talk. You just give the instruction. If he reaches across the table to get the mashed potatoes, you say, ask your sister to pass it. You just give the instruction. Don't scream no. Just give quietly the instruction. I'm seeing a lot of problems with kids that can't get the class on time. That was not a problem for me. Being on time was drilled into me when I was a little kid.
I'm under the impression that you regard autism not as a disorder, but as an alternative way to experience the world. Do I have that right?
Well, I would not want to give up my my more really logical way of thinking. See, autism in its milder forms can give some advantage. You cut out some of the social circuits, then you've got tech circuits to do all kinds of things like give you the recording equipment and stuff that you use for your radio show that wouldn't even exist if it wasn't for, you know, kind of the autistic mind. So a little bit of the trait, you get some benefits. Too much of the trait, you get a severely autistic kid with no speech, obviously. That's not normal. But there's a point where, you know, being a little geeky is just part of the normal continuum. Because then, you know, there's the kind of people that just social yak-yaks and are just kind of an airhead and there just isn't too much on their hard drive.
You have me laughing, and that reminds me that it's often said that autistic people have difficulty decoding emotions and humor in particular. I was a ham radio operator, and I met a guy who suffered from, and suffer maybe is the wrong word, but who told me that he had Asperger's syndrome. And he also told me that, you know, I had sort of the black belt of ham radio, which is the extra class license. And he told me that I was the dumbest extra class he had ever met. He just said that, you know, flat out with any kind of social moderation.
Well, I had to learn some diplomacy because I got fired from a job for writing a letter to the president of one of the meat companies and saying that his engineers were stupid. I did that back when I was in my 20s.
Mm-hmm.
That's not diplomatic, and I've learned not to do things like that. And the best way to mentor these kids is to just explain to them what they're doing wrong. Don't scream at them, and don't worry about offending them. There's a scene in the HBO movie where my boss slams down the deodorant. And that actually happened. You know, he said, you stink, use it. That actually happened. But there's other good things the movie showed, like how I chased after the editor of the Farmer Ranchman magazine, and I got his card so I could write for the magazine. And some people are kind of shocked that I did that. But that's how I got started in the industry. I mean, I'd go up and I'd get people's cards.
Yeah. Now, what about humor? Are there things that you find funny? Do you recognize jokes?
Oh, yes, I recognize jokes, and I really, like a lot of different funny kinds of things. I don't like some of this mean humor. I went to a comedy show on Broadway one time, and it was just all this mean stuff.
Yeah.
You know, you get the dirty talk, and obviously I'm not going to repeat any of that. I don't get that upset about the dirty talk, but I get upset about this meanness. Oh, this one of the things they did, I thought it was just awful.
Yeah.
They had someone come up on the stage and give this comedian their boyfriend's phone number, and their ex-boyfriend that they hated. And the comedian called them up and just swore at them and just said stuff I absolutely can't repeat on radio, and called them all kinds of names and stuff. And that's just mean. And, you know, these Survivor shows where the weak get kicked off. What happened to Roy Rogers' Rules for Living? I mean, those are really good values. You can look them up on the internet. Roy Rogers, he's a famous cowboy from the 50s, and he had really good rules for living. And that's the kind of rules I was brought up with.
Yeah.
We need to have more of that.
Yeah, yeah. Now, you grew up with horses, right?
When I was in high school, I was an absolute horse fanatic, and the only places where I could get away from teasing was horseback riding, electronics, and model rocket club, because the kids that did the teasing were not, you know, did not do those special activities. So I'm a big proponent getting these geeky, nerdy kids into things like Boy Scouts, Future Farmers of America, art club, computer club, robotics competition. You know, some of these specialized activities where they can be in with their peers doing stuff they all like doing together.
Yes, indeed. And, you know, I did mention Rupert Isaacson and the horse boy, and you grew up with horses, and in his story, his autistic son seemed to have a special rapport with horses in particular, that the horses seemed to make allowances or seemed to understand his condition. Have you ever felt that you had any particular rapport with animals or with horses?
Well, my visual thinking mind helped me to understand cattle. I mean, when I first started getting down the chutes in the early 70s and saying, oh, the cattle are balking at the shadow or at the hose going across the ground, people just couldn't understand why the cattle would even look at those details. And I have found that there are certain autistic kids where they just get along with animals in just an amazing way. But it's very variable, because another kid may be afraid of dogs because when it barks, it hurts their ears. And we've got to realize there's a lot of sensory issues. You take the child into a big supermarket or a real noisy train station, and you're wondering why he's screaming. Well, he's screaming because all the sound is causing sensory overload. So the animal is going to be the greatest thing for one kid, and another kid it would not be.
Yes.
Also, I've observed that animals seem to recognize that a child, a very young child, is a juvenile, because I've seen, you know, like four-year-olds dress the cat up in doll's clothes, and the cat lets them do it. But
right.
Wouldn't let a grown-up do that to them.
Yeah, yeah. Is there anyone whose work or way of being in the world particularly inspires you?
Well, I'm inspired by people that get things done. I've got some Einstein posters up on my wall, because in a lot of school systems, he'd be diagnosed with autism. He had no speech until age 3. And I actually have a Xerox copy of a letter Einstein wrote to a parent of an autistic child about 25 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe, maybe it's further ago than that. I got the letter about 25 years ago.
Outside of your discipline, which is animal science, what are you reading these days?
Oh, I read all these science magazines that subscribe to Science, Nature, New Scientist, Scientific American, By Discover on the newsstand. I just love to read science magazines, and I like to keep up on all the latest brain research in autism.
Yes. What's at the cutting edge right now with autism and brain research?
Well, there's been some interesting things with genetics, and it's very much embedded in the genome. It's lots of little tiny code variations, and all these code variations have to do with brain development. And I think, you know, there's going to be no way you can, like, take the autism gene out. Because if you did that, well, you wouldn't have any computer programmers. You wouldn't have any artists. I mean, if you got rid of all of the abnormality, I think we'd have a very boring world. Because when you think about it, who do you think designed the first stone spear? It wasn't the yak-yaks around the campfire.
Okay. Okay. What do you think about the role of the environment in autism? You know, they say that autism seems to be on an upward swing, you know, and I think there's so many pollutants in our environment, and I just have to wonder if that isn't playing a role. Now, you've studied it, the science of all of this, much more closely than I have. What's your thoughts on that?
Well, I think some of the real mild autism is just increased diagnosis, you know, real mild Asperger's, because I can think of the geeks and nerds I went to school with that are doing just fine. And I think part of the problem is a much looser parenting. I mean, kids, there's just not any expectations for behavior. There's no consequences either for bad behavior. And you have to differentiate between bad behavior and a meltdown and temper tantrum in the middle of the supermarket due to sensory overload. You certainly don't punish that. But I think there is some severe autism that's increased, and there's starting to be studies showing that, you know, different pesticides and contaminants are bad. I was just looking at a study in one of my science magazines that places where there was more pesticides in the blood levels, and kids' IQs were lowered 7 points, and this was exposure of the pregnant mother.
Yes.
So there can be, you know, some factors like that. But I'm seeing, showing up at the autism meetings, a lot of, you know, Asperger-y kids. And I read in USA Today, there was a study by a guy named Grinker, and he was looking at autism in Korea. and that there were a lot of kids that were kind of Asperger and autism, but a good percentage of these were in the regular school system and doing quite well. And I think one of the reasons is that, you know, Korean education is going to be a lot more structured, and that's going to really help these kids. You know, there were consequences for bad behavior. I had a temper tantrum at school. Mother would just quietly say, well, no TV tonight. You know, there were consequences. She didn't yell and scream at me, but, you know, I had gotten all those fights, and I lost horseback riding for 2 weeks.
Yeah.
And I stopped fighting.
Yeah.
Now, you see, you don't get into a screaming match with a kid. You know, when I got back home, she'd just say, well, Mrs. Deitch called today, and you had a temper tantrum in school, so there's going to be no TV show tonight.
It sounds like you're quite happy with the HBO rendition of your life. Was there anything that they got wrong or that you were displeased with?
Well, of course they have to, you know, compress things and change some events around. But what I really was happy with is it showed autism accurately. It showed thinking in pictures accurately. It showed the sensory problems accurately, and it showed my building projects accurately, and the main characters, like my science teacher and mother and Anne, they were shown in a real accurate manner. Now, of course, to make a two-hour movie work, they've got to compress and change around some events, but all the main characters are real, and all the things I built and did are real.
Okay, well, good. What are you working on these days? Do you have any projects, or what's at your cutting edge for you right now?
Well, I've been doing a lot of talks lately. That's been a big thing I've been doing. And I get a lot of letters from children saying I've really inspired them, and I really try to make a point of answering things I get from little kids. If you publish my email address, I may get so many I won't be able to answer them, but they can find my email address, but they're going to have to look.
Yes, so that's what I had to do.
I don't think I'm going to give it out.
No.
But if they surf, they can find it on the internet, but they're going to have to look. And most people, when they look for things on the internet, they don't dig deeply enough.
Yeah.
If you watch the movie, it's got clues in the movie on how to find my internet address.
Okay. What do you wish more people understood about autism?
Well, I wish they understood developing the area of strength. You know, if the kid's good at art, let's build up art. You know, the other thing about autism is it's such a big continuum. At one end of the continuum, you've got a famous movie producer who's undiagnosed. You've got, you know, half of Silicon Valley is undiagnosed with autism. And at the other end of the spectrum, you've got somebody that remains nonverbal that's got very, very severe problems, maybe epilepsy and other medical problems on top of autism. So it's a very, very big continuum.
What are your thoughts about medication with children? It seems like there's an awful lot of that going on these days.
Oh, there's way too many powerful meds given out to little kids. I am absolutely appalled and horrified at the amount of risperidone, Abilify, and Seroquel they're giving out like candy to five-year-olds. These kids are getting monstrously fat, and they're also likely to get nerve damage called tardive dyskinesia that causes abnormal movements. It's just terrible bad. I don't know how they ever got that approved by the FDA for autism. But it's so that the worst thing you could give the little kids. Little kids, you know, that are 4 and 5 years old, you might want to try some of the special diets, like the wheat-free diet, dairy-free diet, cut a ton of sugar out. Also, in America, we've got a real omega-3 deficient diet. So taking some fish oil supplements, I'd recommend that. But there is a place for medication in older children and adults. I had horrible panic attacks and nervousness. And as I went through my 20s, my panic attacks got worse and worse and worse. And I've been on a low dose of an antidepressant for over 30 years. They saved me. And in my book, Thinking in Pictures, I have a chapter called A Believer in Biochemistry, where I describe how the antidepressants helped me. I know a lot of visual thinkers that are very, very anxious, even ones that are not labeled autistic, that are taking a little Prozac in the morning. And it's really helping them, because it stops the anxiety. I know a lot of visual thinkers professionally in the movie industry and in the design industry that take Prozac, and it's keeping them off of drugs and alcohol and other bad things. But the thing is, you gotta take a really tiny, tiny dose of the Prozac, much lower than oftentimes the starter dose, because if you take too much, you're going to get agitation and insomnia. And that's explained in detail in Thinking in Pictures, the new edition, and The Way I See It, second edition. You need to make sure you get Thinking in Pictures, the second edition for medication, and Thinking in Pictures, the 2006 edition. But the old edition still doesn't have some of the new drugs, but the information in there is still right.
Thank you for all of that. And I did get to see your on on the computer. I saw your presentation, your TED.com presentation. And that's such a prestigious venue, I think, to be invited to. And people are challenged to give the best presentation of their career in a very limited amount of time. I think they give you, what, 18 minutes or something?
I had 18 minutes, and I just did TEDx in Denver, and they give you 12 minutes. And that's, I like crammed a 45-minute lecture into 12 minutes. I hope it, I'm afraid it might sound rushed.
Well, that... The one that I saw at the regular TED.com, how much preparation did that take for you? Did you actually rehearse it a lot ahead of time? And I, you know, we talked about humor before too, and you managed to get humor into your talks.
Well, I have to prepare the slides beforehand, obviously.
Sure.
And I, one of the things I do is I take the slides after I've got them and I go through them and I look at them. I don't actually rehearse it by talking it.
Okay.
But I rehearse it by taking the slides, and I have them printed out on a piece of paper. And I look at them really carefully and go, now what am I going to say on each slide? Then you probably notice I had a little piece of paper in my hand. In that paper, I've got main bullet points I want to go over, especially if it's something not on the slide, but it's just bullet points. But I do quite a lot of time just sitting there thinking about what I'm going to say on each slide. I don't do it verbally rehearsing it, but I'm going, okay, I can spend this much time on this slide, this much on this time. This slide I'm going to talk about this, and this slide I'm going to talk about this. And I've got this many seconds, you know, for each slide.
How did you learn to get some humor into your presentations?
That's something that happened gradually. You know, and then I find some jokes worked, some jokes didn't work. And you gradually learn. You see, the thing about autism is it's bottom-up thinking. It's not top-down. So to understand something in the future, I have to compare it back to something in the past. So the more experiences I've had, the better I get. I'd read evaluations really carefully. I can remember early in my academic career that a student wrote on my evaluation that I always gave the same lecture. So what I did is I switched, this is back in the days of 35-millimeter slides, so I switched the my slides around. I got rid of my first slide that I always used.
Yeah.
And it was on cattle vision. I used to go, cattle have wide-angle vision. They can see all around without moving their head. I got rid of that slide. Now I have it, but it's not the first slide anymore.
Yeah, yeah.
So because what I figured was happening is I always used that first slide, even though the rest of the presentation was different. Well, now I don't do that anymore.
Uh-huh.
Each presentation I have, I use a different first slide.
Okay. Well, you've made valuable contributions to the world. Are there other autistic people who come to mind as having made valuable contributions?
Well, absolutely. We already talked about Einstein. He'd be labeled autistic today. And there's a book about Asperger's called Asperger's and Self-Esteem. It's about famous scientists and musicians that probably had Asperger's. Another book's called Genius Genes. You can buy those books on Amazon. And just look at Silicon Valley. I mean, you know, just look at some of the talks some of those people do. I'll let you come to your own conclusions. But, I mean, half of Silicon Valley has got some Asperger's, though most of it's undiagnosed. And the reason why the techies and the artists often avoid the label, because I find that the verbal thinkers can't seem to get away from the label. Because what I'm seeing, I see one geek becomes a Hollywood producer, another geek runs a major Silicon Valley company, and another geek ends up in the basement playing video games on Social Security payments. That's not where you want them to go. And they're all the same. They're all the same guy. See, I see the guy. I don't see the label.
Yes.
And I think a lot of people in the tech community avoid the label like the plague because they're worried about holding the kids back. And then there's some kids. You get more severe autistic kids. They need the label. And they need the services. But some of these geeky kids, there's just the ones where there's a lot of mentoring. You know, they teach the kid programming or art at an early age. You know, a lot of the kids that are successful are mentored into something. What I'm seeing right now in looking at jobs, and I'm very concerned about getting jobs for people, is the visual thinkers like me and the mathematicians often have an easier time getting a job because we can show off a portfolio. Like I designed the front end on all the animal handling of all the Cargill beef plants in North America. How did I get that job? in the late 80s, I sent a gorgeous portfolio, very professionally presented, to the head of Cargill, and they liked it. And it was something where you could open it up, and in 30 seconds, he went, wow. You know, you want to make sure you don't put too much stuff in your portfolio. A programmer can show off some programming code. A musician can show off his music. But the other kind of thinker, and there's three kinds of specialized thinkers in autism. There's a photorealistic visual thinker like me, bad in things like algebra. There's the mathematics mind, the pattern thinker, music and math mind. These kids often have trouble with reading. And then there's the word thinker. This is a kid that knows every fact about his favorite subject and can memorize lines from movies. And I'm finding that this group now is having a harder time getting jobs because a lot of the jobs they'd be good at, like, you know, mid-level office jobs, filing, typing, doing a lot of that work's now getting obsolete. And some of these guys, they'd be really good at specialty retail because they'd know all the products. They'd be good journalists. And they have an unfortunate tendency to get radical views on politics, and that turns a lot of people off. I just learned, leave sex, religion, and politics at home. We don't need those subjects at work, and I'm not going to discuss them because they are too controversial. But we've got to find something that the person would be good at. Some of the verbal thinkers are good at technical writing. They'd be good at that. But one area that I think they can be really good at, specialty retail, because they would know every kind of, electronics that's in the store.
Sure.
You know, they could tell you everything about every kind of phone. Now, they're not going to be able to tell you how the programming works, but they could tell you every feature a phone has and know everything, you know, how the iPhone 4 is different from the Android, and it's got this features and that one doesn't have that features. They could tell you all that kind of stuff. Fantastic memory. But I think we've got to start working on training kids for job skills in middle school. We need to start introducing kids to careers when they're in middle school. And there's a lot of kids that could get careers in the hands-on things. Like, I've talked to some of the oil company people. There's a shortage of certified welders right now. They're wondering who's going to replace us geezers when we retire from welding. And that's a great job, pays a lot of money. And for some kids, those hands-on jobs are really great jobs.
Yes.
We need to take them out and show them an oil rig and show them that oil rigs have joysticks. You know, that's the kind of thing you need to show to middle school kids to get them turned on about a career. Because I'm seeing too many of them not getting employed.
Yeah. Well, you have such a practical and wide-ranging turn of mind. I can just see that you could have many careers yourself, and one of them maybe should be a management consultant.
Well, I'm doing what's happening on my livestock handling. In the beginning, I strictly just worked on equipment design. Build the job, get in there, and get out. Now I'm getting more into, I've worked on animal welfare auditing. In fact, 10 years ago, I implemented the McDonald's and Wendy's audits for slaughter plants. I developed a scoring system for a very simple, practical scoring system for evaluating slaughter plants for animal welfare. Like if you have more than 3 cattle moo when they go up the chute, you fail the McDonald's audit. And if that keeps happening, you're going to get taken off the approved supplier list. I developed this whole system, implemented it. You see, that's more of the management side.
Yeah.
Because when I first started out, I thought I could fix everything in the plant with equipment. What I've found is I can only fix half of it with equipment. The other half is operating that equipment right.
Uh-huh.
And when you have major restaurant companies inspecting these plants, that makes them do stuff right. But you got to have something practical. You can't have something like do it properly. What does that mean?
Yes.
What is proper handling? What's proper, you know, proper equipment? I don't know. You've got to be more specific.
Yeah, you've got to spell it out, just like you were talking about education with autistic kids. You've got to break it down into concrete steps.
Well, and the other thing with a lot of these kids, I'm teaching social rules, and I'm seeing these kids aren't taught any social rules. They don't know how to shop. By the time I was 8 years old, I could go in a store and shop by myself, and I knew how to behave. You know, and I wasn't pulling stuff off the shelves and running behind the counters, because if I ran behind the counter, Mother didn't yell at me. She'd say, only the clerks are allowed behind the counter. Come out.
Mm-hmm.
She would give the instruction.
Yes.
That, I think, is very, very important. And we need to be teaching these social rules just out in the community. We've got to, you know, if a kid eats his potatoes with his hands, French fries is okay, but let's say it's mashed potatoes. Mashed potatoes with your hands, you say, use the fork.
Mm-hmm.
You just give the instruction. You don't yell it. You just say calmly and firmly, use your fork to eat the potatoes. And then if he doesn't do that, you know, and I'm talking about a kid that's verbal here. I'm not talking about, you deal with some of the ones that are nonverbal. They wouldn't even understand what you meant when you said that. But I'm talking about a fully verbal kid. You just tell them what to do. And then it's going to be, there needs to be a point where there'd be some consequences for eating potatoes with your hands.
Yes, yes. Well, you've been very generous with your time. Is there any final thought you'd like to leave our listeners with before we close off here?
Develop the kid's strength. And we need to be thinking a lot more when they get to middle school. And I know we have some international viewers. That's going to be, you know, like 12, 14 years old. We got to start thinking about what's that child going to do when he grows up? Kids need to be learning work skills. You know, like, you know, here in America, it used to be delivering papers. Well, how about walking dogs for, you know, for the next door neighbors?
Mm-hmm.
Because they got to learn that responsibility that you got to walk them every single day. Even if it's raining, you got to walk Mrs. Jones's dog because it's your job. And I'm not seeing enough job skill training. And I when I was 13, I did a seamstress job 2 afternoons a week. When I was 15, I took care of 9 horses and I cleaned out their stalls. And when they took away horseback riding, they didn't take away cleaning out the stalls. I still had to clean the stalls out. I just couldn't ride them for 2 weeks. I still cleaned out the stalls.
Yeah, right. Dr. Temple Grandin, thanks for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Well, thank you for having me.
Well, I have to say I'm especially grateful to Dr. Temple Grandin for this interview because she went above and beyond the call of duty. Let me explain what I mean. Yesterday afternoon, I went out to a party in the countryside near where I live to celebrate the birthday of the woman who was my administrative assistant during the years I was psychology department chair at Sonoma State University. And they had a full bar at this party. Now, I'm not much of a drinker. I often prefer hard liquor, though, to wine because wine makes me sleepy. And they had a full bar at this party, and I felt like celebrating and maybe getting a little loose because there were a lot of people there that I didn't know at this party. And so I figured a little social lubricant might come in handy. So I had a martini. As I say, I'm not much of a drinker, and I might have 2 martinis in a year, just to give you an idea. Well, I was still feeling no pain when I left the party. As I was getting into my car, my iPhone started ringing, and I tried to answer it, but it wasn't working, but I heard a voice saying, Temple Grandin. So I'm thinking, oh my goodness, this is Temple Grandin, and I don't want to lose her. And I'm saying, please hang on, please hang on. And I'm fumbling with my phone, and I realize the issue is that the call has gone to my Bluetooth device in my car, but that device isn't fully turned on and enabled. So I finally get that booted up after a lot of fumbling and turn on the car radio, and now I can hear her and she can hear me. Well, I'm so surprised to be getting a call from Temple Grandin at 7:30 on a Saturday evening, especially considering that it had been a week or so since I tried emailing an interview invitation to an address that I wasn't even sure was hers. And generally, the way things go, I send out an email invitation, then I get an email back from the invitee, if I'm lucky, and then there are a couple of emails back and forth as we set up a date and a time for the interview, get a signed release and a photo, and take care of other details. Now, Temple Grandin is such a celebrity that I wasn't at all sure that I could get her to come on the show. Now, here she is unexpectedly on the phone, and she's ready to be interviewed, like right now. So I explained to her that I'm in my car and that I will go straight home, and can I interview her in an hour? She says, okay, but makes it clear that she's in a different time zone and it's getting close to her bedtime. So I go racing home. Now, I always have a page or two of questions prepared ahead of time for these interviews, but I don't have any questions prepared for Temple because I didn't even know she had received my email. Plus my head is still kind of muddled from that martini. It's really hard to think straight. So I get home, I boot up my computer, get the software set up, turn off the other phone that could ring during the interview and create a distraction, and all the other little pre-interview steps and details. I call her, and it's clear there's no time for chit-chat and that she's ready to get down to business. So we jump right into the interview. And I thought it went well, but about halfway through, I began to be nervous as to whether or not it was getting recorded. I was sure I had clicked on the software button to start the recording as soon as she picked up the phone, but something in the software display didn't look right. I pressed ahead with the interview, though, because we were too far in to ask her to start over, and I was hoping I was wrong about it not recording. However, as soon as we got off the phone, I discovered that indeed I was right, and it had not recorded, and I was heartbroken. In over 300 interviews, this has happened a couple of times before, only a couple of times. As a result, I've created a checklist of things that I run through. I really thought I had done the whole checklist, and I don't know if it was the martini or the pressure of time and my excitement about getting a chance to interview Temple, but something had gone wrong. My wife suggested I should call her back, but I was too mortified, and plus I knew she was planning to go to bed. I was still fretting about it this morning over breakfast, and my wife again suggested I should just call her and explain what had happened. I was reluctant, but today is Sunday, and I know she has a full schedule of speaking and teaching and writing and researching, so I thought, well, maybe Sunday might be a day with some space in it. So I summoned up my courage. I first made sure I was recording before commanding Skype to dial her number. I didn't want that to happen twice. I explained what happened when she came on the line, minus the martini part. She was upset to hear that the recording hadn't happened, but then was gracious enough to say, well, let's do it again right now. So that's what you heard, the second take. And by the way, she told me that this wasn't the first time that this had happened to her. I would have felt terrible to have come so close and not be able to bring Temple Grandin to you. Autistic people in general are not noted for their flexibility. Temple Grandin is exceptional because she breaks the mold in so many special ways. So thanks again, Temple. And I must confess, I had not seen the HBO movie. I've just ordered it on Netflix, and I'm looking forward to watching it. If you're interested in autism, you will definitely want to go to Dr. Temple Grandin's website at www.templegrandin.com. And Temple is spelled T-E-M-P-L-E, and Grandin is G-R-A-N-D-I-N. And she is truly grand.
You're on the couch again with Dr. Dave. And Shrink Wrap Radio is playing on again. Yeah. It's all in your head. It's all in your head. Shrink Wrap Radio.
Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head.
Hello, everyone. I think I announced on the last show that I'd be changing up the format a bit, particularly in the beginning of the show. So today's episode is an example of that. You'll notice I got into the interview a lot quicker and didn't spend as much time on the guest's background and credentials. If you go to the Shrink Wrap Radio website, however, you'll find that that longer background bio is there. I'm hoping you're okay with these changes. As I mentioned before, I'm exploring having these episodes carried on another online network, in addition to the places where you're used to listening to the show. and I'm trying to reduce the amount of work as much as possible required to have two different versions of the show. In time, I'm hoping that the two will match up so that the extra work will be very minimal. So we'll see whether or not that works out and whether it's worth the effort. I don't recall if I have already mentioned it. I think I did. But I'll be attending the International Positive Psychology Association Second World Congress in Philadelphia. So I'll be gone from July 22nd through July 27th. And I don't think that will cause any interruption in the usual podcast schedule. But it will mean some great new interviews on positive psychology, which I'm still quite interested in. And I hope you are too. Be sure to listen to my interview with Marshall Lewis about Viktor Frankl and logotherapy on my other podcast series at wisecounselpodcast.com, if you haven't done so already. By the time you hear this, however, there may be a new show up there, and I believe it will be with Dr. Kristen Neff on self-compassion. She's a psychologist, a university professor, and a Buddhist practitioner. And by the way, she is the mother of Rowan, the horse boy, and wife of Rupert Isaacson, who I recently interviewed about the horse boy film. Good people, great interview. Oh, and speaking of positive psychology, I just put up a new blog post on my blog for Psychology Today. If you do a Google search on the Happiness Dispatch, you'll find that blog. And the title of my latest posting there is Just Deal With It? Really? In which I react to a remark made by Martin Seligman during someone else's interview with him. I'd really like to get some different sponsors going here. If you have a business or service you'd like me to verbally promote here, please drop me a line and let's see if we can work something out. Or if you'd like to have a banner on our website, such as those you currently see in the right-hand sidebar on shrinkwrapradio.com, let's talk about that. Unfortunately, I have no new transcripts to announce. If you'd like to volunteer your services as a transcriber, do let me know. But it does involve some work, so keep that in mind. Now, those of you who have not made a financial commitment to supporting Shrink Wrap Radio, please go ahead and do so by clicking on the big green donate button in the right-hand sidebar on shrinkwrapradio.com. There is a lot of time and effort that goes into bringing these shows to you. It is a labor of love, but some financial support helps keep it flowing. For example, airfare to Philadelphia and lodging there will eat up about a year's worth of donations, but it puts me in touch with the sorts of high-caliber professionals that I like to be able to bring to your ears and brain. So thanks to all of you who have helped and who will help to make that possible.
Hi, this is author, psychoanalyst, and Buddhist teacher Dr. Pilar Jennings, and you're on the couch with Dr. Dave.
Thank you, Dr. Pilar Jennings, who will probably be my guest on our next episode, and I'll explain that probably qualification in a bit. Let's grab a couple of recent emails from our listener community. First, we hear from Anthony, who writes, "Hi, Dr. Dave. It has been a pleasure to listen to your podcasts. They are very addictive. Anyway, not one for beating around the bush. Today, two new ideas came to me while driving. I said to myself, these would be good fodder for Dr. Dave. Well, here they are. Music and its effect on mind and society, in particular, trance music, and at the other extreme, classical. Gayness, the act of being gay, expression, thoughts, and its effects on the mind, the contradictions it has to social norms, and also at the other extreme, heterosexuality. What are its effects on the mind, too? What makes us sexual, bi, straight, or hetero? And OCDs, obsessive compulsive disorder, and its effect on relationships and individuals. Kind regards, and your work is most appreciated." Well, Anthony, it's great to hear from you. I'll try to keep using that secret sauce that makes it addictive, try to keep the addiction going. And I referred Anthony to some past Wise Counsel episodes in which I have dealt with OCD and several dealing with topics relating to sexuality and particularly gay topics, gay research, I remember one, and I have an upcoming one on Wise Counsel, an interview with a psychiatrist who came out as gay in midlife, in his late 40s, as I recall. So be sure to follow that one, and I'll keep those ideas in mind, and the one about music, too. And next, we hear from Linda, who writes, "Hi, Dr. Dave. Just wanted to comment on the recent shows with Jerry. I have really enjoyed them and hope, as you hinted during the latest episode, that there will be more to come. I would especially like to hear more about the benefits of learning Jerry's technique. Has Jerry found meaning and or insights from the visions that appear during his meditations? Has hypnagogia slash lucid dreaming made a difference in his life? Since hearing Jerry's first interview on this subject, I have begun practicing and do find it interesting and relaxing, but wonder if other benefits might be realized. Thanks, Dr. Dave, for your continued excellence in podcasting." And that's from Linda. And Linda, I will be pumping Jerry for that information. Maybe we'll have him back on to share that at some point. And finally, one more from Anthony, who wrote in response to the letter I read last time, to an email I read last time, relating to, I think it was last time, relating to a kind of a cultural bias against Christianity, and even raising the question that maybe I had been unconsciously biased. Anthony writes, "Thank you so much for your courageous reading of the letter pointing out cultural bias against Christianity and Christians. You deserve a lot of praise for a lifetime of pursuing truth and knowledge and refusing Kool-Aid when it is offered." Thank you. "I believe the writer made some excellent points, and I commend you for sharing them and for your kind and thoughtful response. Like you, I was never willing to accept that God would condemn a good person just because he doesn't happen to have met a missionary or undergone a ritual like baptism. My attitude was that any God I would believe in would be fair. I also believe that truth simply is. It is knowable and discoverable, and no group can claim to have exclusive access to it. I believe seeking truth is at least morally neutral and probably morally good, and any religion saying I should stop thinking or investigating or ignore perfectly good scientific knowledge has no need of me. Religious texts can be tremendous shortcuts both to truths and to falsehoods." Interesting point. A beloved spiritual leader of mine had this to say on the topic: "Every principle that the Lord has revealed carries with it its own conviction of its truth. That means good people of all faiths can ultimately agree on everything. We just come to our knowledge via different paths. Today, I am a member of a Christian sect which believes that God blesses and favors all good people, regardless of their faith or degree of religious knowledge. We believe that when Christ comes again and the wicked people are removed from the earth, some of those will be wicked Christians, and those remaining will represent good people of all faiths. We even take the biblical phrase, 'every knee shall bow,' to refer to an acknowledgement of governmental authority, not a lack of religious diversity or tolerance. Even though I'm now a Christian myself, I hope and pray you will continue to seek truth and soundly reject any faith, church, or religion that asks you to stop using your moral or scientific judgment or to accept an unfair or unreasonable God as your master. If the guy in charge up there weren't fair, what would be the point of obeying him anyway? Yours very truly." And that comes from David. And David, you've made some very interesting points that I haven't heard that particular stance articulated from a Christian point of view before. Things are definitely evolving, and I think that's a good thing. So, as usual, that will wrap it up for today. You can send your emails to me, shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. You can make comments about individual shows on the site. And my phone number that nobody ever seems to use is 206-337-0622. Thanks to Dr. Temple Grandin for her very compelling look into visual thinking and the inner world of Asperger's syndrome. On the next episode, my guest will be Dr. Pilar Jennings, speaking about the power of relationship in psychoanalysis and Buddhism. Meditate on that. Actually, I may need to squeeze in an interview with Dr. Robert Diener before that in order to get it out in time to promote the Positive Psychology Conference that I'll be attending in Philadelphia. He's one of the main presenters there. I'm keen to interview him, and I've committed to help promote the conference. So we'll see. That one actually might be the next one. So until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
Thank you.